This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Why are you here? Where are you taking me? What have I done? That's what a young Polish doctor asked the Gestapo as they came for her in the middle of a freezing January night in 1944 in Poland. That arrest began the ordeal for Dr. Jadwiga Lenartowicz, a Nazi prisoner for 15 months. She endured a women's prison, 3 concentration camps, 4 slave labor camps, and a death march. But she survived. She and her fellow prisoners were liberated by the U.S. 87th Infantry Division 70 years ago this week. After the war, she came to Michigan with her husband and daughter, seeking a new life. She found that new life, but at a price. Her Polish medical credentials lost in the war, she was never able to practice medicine in America. Instead, she worked as a nurse's aide at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. But she lived a long life and a rich life, dying in 2010 at age 100. Her powerful story is told in a new book by Barbara Rilko-Bauer, a Polish doctor in the Nazi camps. It's one of the Michigan notable books for 2015. Barbara Rilko-Bauer is an anthropologist who teaches at Michigan State University, and she is the proud daughter of Dr. Jadwiga Lenartowicz Rilko. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your mother was a 33-year-old physician, a Roman Catholic. Where was she living and working when she was arrested by the Nazis?
She was living in one of the major cities in Poland, Łódź. That's the Polish pronunciation, but a lot of people know it as Lodz,
okay.
L-O-D-Z.
And why was she arrested?
She was arrested because she and a number of other friends were listening to radio broadcasts secretly from time to time. And this was something that was strictly forbidden by the Nazis.
Yeah, as you read A Polish Doctor in the Nazi Camps, you get such a ground-level sense of what it was like when the Nazis came in. I mean, you give us her childhood, which was a wonderful childhood, mm-hmm. and her education. But then when they came in, it seems that the Polish experience was just extra brutal because of the way the Germans regarded the Poles.
Yes, they did. And the persecution, you know, began immediately. So there were a lot of rules and regulations laid down, a lot of things that were forbidden. Schools and universities and churches were closed down. And
they weren't just targeting the Jewish community. We know that they virtually decimated Poland's Jews, but
yes.
So many other groups were targeted, weren't they?
They were. The fact that my mother lived in Łódź was really an important kind of touchstone for me, because it always reminded me of the fact that while a lot of groups were targeted, homosexuals, mm-hmm. people with mental and physical disabilities, and a lot of Slavic populations, including the Poles, the Jews, of course, were targeted in a special way. And so if my mother had been Jewish, she would have, by February 1940, left her home and been put into what turned out to be a very small area with a lot of people packed in, the Łódź ghetto. Mm-hmm. So there is a difference. There is a difference in the way that the persecution and targeting was done. But definitely the Poles were targeted, and they suffered a lot.
And once you're hauled off by the Gestapo to the women's prison in Łódź, that things are not going to be good.
No.
give us a sense of her journey and also how they treated her.
She was arrested in the early hours of January 13th, 1944, was sent to the prison. She spent 9 weeks there, and it was a very difficult prison with very poor food, you know, a lot of overcrowding. And then on March 16th, in the early hours of the morning, they seem to do these things in the early hours of the morning, she and 78 other women were taken by train to the large main women's concentration camp in Germany called Ravensbrück. She was there for about 6 weeks, and then she was chosen along with 7 other women who just happened to be physicians, and they were reassigned to work as prisoner doctors in Jewish slave labor camps for another concentration camp system called Gross Rosen. She kind of wandered through several different mm-hmm. camps.
Some better than others.
Yes. And then eventually ended up in the camp that she was assigned to, which was a Jewish slave labor camp. There were about 1,000 Jewish women who worked as slaves for the German textile firm Gruschwitz. It was in the town of Neusalz, the German town of Neusalz. And so she worked there with a Jewish dentist and she had like 6 weeks of training, this young woman. Mm-hmm. And they shared a barrack together, and they kind of were the medical clinic for these 1,000 Jewish women.
It gives one a real sense that there were different purposes mm-hmm. that the Germans had for their prisoners. Mm-hmm. Some were to be just gotten rid of if mm-hmm. you were very young or you were very old or you were not well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting that they even made any effort at all to try to keep these slave prisoners even vaguely healthy with your mother's care. Mm-hmm.
The whole notion of having hospitals and infirmaries and concentration camps is kind of a paradox, and it's something that, you know, has fascinated me and I want to continue studying. But on the one hand, you had the ideology, you know, where a lot of people were considered less than human. And of course, the Jews were kind of at the top of that list, according to the Nazis. But then you also had a need for labor. I mean, most of the men were, you know, fighting on the fronts. And so the ideology that was very racist and very brutal.
Get rid of them all.
Right. Conflicted with the economic need that, you know, well, we need to be making armaments, we need to be making uniforms for German soldiers and things like that. And oftentimes it didn't make sense.
None. And treatment varied from camp to camp, mm-hmm. didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And there were actually, I don't know if the word humane is right, but there were some Germans she encountered who were better than others.
Mm-hmm. My mother termed this fortune within misfortune, that she had situations, and this is how 60 years later she viewed it. So, you know, when she was in the prison and actually ill with, you know, diarrhea and so forth, very shortly before they were going to be transferred to Ravensbrück. And as a physician, she realized she was going to be signing her death warrant if she went in that kind of state. One of the guards, who happened to be a Pole of German descent and whose sister, my mother had treated the sister's children before the war, she snuck in some charcoal tablets and vermouth. And my mother was able to get better and, you know, went off on that transport feeling a little bit more secure. So,
which could get you through the clearance once you got there. I would like to ask you to read us an excerpt from your book, A Polish Doctor in the Nazi Camps. And this is where your mother looked through a book about the Ravensbrück concentration camp where she had been a prisoner.
Because my mother expressed an interest in learning what other survivors recalled about their experiences in the camps where she had been, I loaned her a memoir about Ravensbrück, a slim volume written by Genevieve de Gaulle Antonioz, niece of General Charles de Gaulle, titled The Dawn of Hope. My mother stayed up reading late into the night. When I visited her the following day, she shared her impressions with me. This author, she had it much worse than I did. She was locked up in a punishment cell and tortured. At least, I was never tortured. Then my mother paused, visibly upset, and her eyes filled with tears. When I was reading this account, the memories flooded back. I said to myself, this is me, the shaved hair, the wooden clogs. I saw it all again right before my eyes. I'll never lose this image, these memories. And then, you know, I began to cry. I cried for quite a while, but then I pulled myself together. Enough, I said. You know, Bashu, it took me a long while to fall asleep last night. Again, I was racked with feelings of guilt and uncertainty about our project. What was I putting my mother through? And for what purpose? Was my desire to document her story justifiable in light of the consequences? Afterward, as we sipped tea and ate slices of her freshly baked lemon pound cake, I voiced my concerns. I asked her how she felt and whether she thought we should continue our interviews and conversations about her painful past. I was reassured when she insisted that we forge ahead. The violence Yadja and her fellow prisoners endured, the nakedness, public exams and shaving, racks for clothes, inhumane living conditions, and heartless treatment, was not only physical violation, but also psychological, emotional, and symbolic assault aimed at destroying the women's sense of dignity, worth, identity, personhood. The loss of their hair, crudely clipped and shaved, reinforced the message, you are now powerless, sexless, featureless, and nameless, no longer a person. Yadja's experience of what she referred to as the degradation of humanity, or poniżenie człowieczeństwa, meaning not just what she herself went through at Ravensbrück, but also what she saw all around her, became the standard by which she judged the rest of her concentration camp experiences.
That's Barbara Rilke-Bauer reading from her memoir, A Polish Doctor in the Nazi Camps. You know, and reading your account of your mother's life in the camps and her memories and seeing the photos of her from the era, she seemed very dignified, even at the worst of it. She stares at that camera with a very clear, steady gaze. And it seemed to me that she's very focused on not losing her humanity and her dignity. And I wondered, how do you think that helped her not only survive, but then make the very tough transition when she came here to Michigan to live after the war?
I think that was very important to her. I mean, I think that she had a sense of who she was. And I think even when she was not able eventually to get, you know, licensure, I mean, she tried, and there's a whole chapter devoted to that in the book. But even then, she never lost her identity as a physician. So she would work as a nurse's aide at Henry Ford Hospital. But even there, the physicians knew her story. And she would tell me with a little bit of irony, she said they would always ask for me when they had the most difficult patients because they knew that I would know what to do. And she probably did some of the stuff that nurses normally do. So I think she really, at her core, was able to hold on to who she was as a person. And, you know, I don't know where she got that strength from, but it certainly was very critical, I think, in her survival.
You could hear her voice as she recounted, even in the part you just read, where she will feel the pain and then kind of go, snap out of it, move on.
And that is my mother. One of her favorite, I remember her saying so many times, she'd say, grit your teeth. Don't give in.
Lesson that she learned.
Yeah.
Barbara, did you grow up with an awareness of everything your mother had endured? What was your consciousness as a kid?
You know, I knew my father was a prisoner of war for 5.5 years. He was a colonel in the Polish army. And I knew that my mother was a concentration camp prisoner.
And they met in a DP camp after the war. Yes.
And but, you know, I had an awareness, and people would talk about things, but they would talk more about, like, there would be anecdotes. There wasn't any focus on, you know, the horrors of it all. And so I didn't know the details until I finally, quite late in my own life, sat down and convinced my mother to start sharing things with me.
And, you know, you're an anthropologist.
Yes.
A medical anthropologist. And you're Yaja's daughter. So two distinct viewpoints. Did you make a conscious decision of which one was going to be the preeminent voice in this book?
It was a struggle for quite a while, whether I would write this as a daughter who happened to be an anthropologist or as an anthropologist who just so happened to be interviewing her mother. I got to a certain point where I really realized that this was an important story and also an important history. For me, the history is also another story, the backstory. And I really wanted to share it with a broad audience. And I knew that if I wrote it like an academic book, I would lose people after page 5. And so I chose to write it as a daughter, you know, but the way that I approached the subject matter itself was as an anthropologist. So I did a lot of scholarly research. And when it came right down to the writing, I really tried to write it so that somebody who... I wanted my mother's caretakers. My mother, at the end of her life, had to go into skilled nursing. She was driving at age 95, but by 97, dementia was setting in and she was going blind. I wanted her caretaker, Nura, to read this story.
To get a sense of who. And, you know, we as children don't ever have that clear view of who our parents really, really are. And you know, you had long, difficult conversations and taping sessions with your mother at her dining room table. And your reward was getting a much, much fuller sense of just who she was before she was your
Absolutely.
Mom.
Yeah.
What are some do's and don'ts that you might offer to people who might want to do something similar with their own parents? Your anthropologist training, I think, would be helpful here.
I'm getting letters from people, which is really wonderful, emails. And I've had several people who have said, you know, I really want to talk to my mother or my grandparents. And yet, you know, they're reluctant to talk, just as my mother. And so I kind of suggest going slowly. And in my case, I started with photographs from the post-war era in Germany. And, you know, they were all in a shoebox, and my mother was not a put them in nice little scrapbooks. And there were happy photographs of, you know, when my parents married and so forth. And then we talked about her childhood. So I think starting with something that isn't the core of the story, you know, the dramatic part, but starting with something that's kind of
gentle.
Gentle, yes. That's a good word.
Yes, a gentle start. Yeah. As you went through this entire process of talking with your mother, doing this research, and then putting all of that into your book, A Polish Doctor in the Nazi Camps, what most surprised you or most struck you?
I mean, I was, of course, very struck with some of the things my mother experienced. And I got a realization at one point when my mother was talking with me and, you know, and she said, I was never tortured. And I remembered later that night just falling apart kind of and realizing, what would it be like to hear your mother say that she was raped or to hear her tell you that she was, you know, beaten or whatever other. I mean, there were enough terrible things. But so that was one. But I also was so shocked by the history. I'd never really known. I just wasn't that interested in this history. My first book about the Holocaust I read, other than Anne Frank in, you know, elementary school, was when I started on this project. So I've learned a lot of history, and I was just struck by the immensity of the Nazi concentration camp system, the prison system, which now scholars at the Holocaust Museum in Washington are putting at about over 40,000 different kinds of places of incarceration. And just the slave labor and how the ideology, the military, and industry all worked together and fed off of the lives of millions of people.
Barbara Rielkobauer's book is A Polish Doctor in the Nazi Camps, My Mother's Memories of Imprisonment, Immigration, and a Life Remade. It's a stunning book. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure for me.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts.